You have the money. You have the abundance,
but
right?
Why would I change it?
That's the question. Why would you change it? It's a more upgradable model. You're moving from not specific. I'm not going to name any brands because I don't want to bring in any further discussions or further debates. But phone A to phone B, phone 16 to phone 17.
Yeah.
This crazy culture of there is one level above this. I'm waiting. Let me get that one. It came out just recently. Let me get that one. Is that a good culture per se? Upgrading when you have the abundance, you have that money. Should you keep upgrading? Is that something necessarily good?
Not necessarily. No, never. We sometimes need stuff and we go for them. But this, I have harsh criticism regarding this idea that many, even children learn today that you have to change your phone from this to that. My students keep asking me in the class, teacher, what is your phone? Oh, that phone came out. Why didn't you go for this one? Why didn't you change it to the new one? I mean, even children and kids know today that they have to go for the best ranks, for the best brands. They have to keep upgrading. But why? I mean, my question is has been always this, why?
Why can't we just be... Let's look at both the scenarios, both the sides. Why can't we just be content and satisfied with what we have until it no longer satisfied our needs, than to just, you know, crazily and, you know, extremely anxiously go after upgrading. Take a look at both the sides. I'm now, there is a new upgraded thing, but this, what I have is looking after my needs perfectly.
Yeah, it's still working.
Yeah, so there is no problem in that. And this new thing is, I'm just putting more money into it. Right?
And some people do need the upgraded version. Like if my job is something
exactly.
that has to be done by the phone, for example, with the laptop, and I have to keep upgrading because I have to be upgrading my job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's accepted in this case.
You know where we really get that conflict is when we think about the progress, human progress, technological progress. It's actually driven by the by the sales that happen in the market. So let's say a phone company brings in phone X, and then let me give a number to it, phone 12, and then for a year they have invested in their R&D and their research and development, and then they bring in phone 13 now. Right? They've upgraded from one to the other. Now, what if everybody stays with that phone 12 and does not go buy the phone 13? That company will basically dilute, will basically go bankrupt because they're not having any sales. Now, this, why I brought this up is because this culture is not necessarily only for consumers, us as the Gen Z consumers, but it's a general societal culture, and this needs to change. And you know how socially this affects? Take a look at people who look at other people and they see that they're upgrading and they're somewhat improving in the apparent part of it. If you look at the shell of it, they're improving. And they might have the abundance of wealth to do so, but you don't. And this person who doesn't is constantly in that state of, how I wish I had that much money. I wish I had this.
Yeah.
I wish I had
and
that.
And social media is
exactly. This social culture is going to not only stop between the companies and the consumers upgrading, but it's going to encroach into people who are not upgrading and saying, maybe I should do so. And they are now under pressure, both in terms of wealth, both in terms of other aspects of their life, just for the sake of upgrading, they upgrade.
Yeah, exactly. As you truly mentioned it, we have to keep this balance, this education, this mindset, this literacy, that not everything that is upgraded, that is called to be new, has to be necessarily mine. We have to keep this literacy that once we need something, we can go for it, or unless we can just forget about them.
And I think we did enlist a lot of challenges in this episode, and we did clearly draw the line between what should be a disposable and what should not be disposable. Whatever is fixable, we should try our best to do so. And this consumer culture needs to change, not only on the consumer level, but entire society. Both the businesses and the consumers need to take heed that, being content with what we have, there's a lot more to be said. And unfortunately, we are way out of our limit in terms of time. Inshallah, maybe, we're not sure. Maybe if we do have the opportunity and the tawfiq, we'll definitely touch on this topic in another episode, inshallah. For now, we will bid you farewell. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah. Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Iran is known for its four-season climate and the climatic variety in each of its regions. This time, the lavender fields of North Khorasan province have invited us so that we could discover a part of natural beauties in northeastern Iran.
The land of a thousand colors, with a wild and vibrant nature, where kings and poets have been inspired by its beauties throughout the ages. A place where fountains keep the rivers flowing like the never-ending tales of Shahrazad in the 1,000 Nights and a Night.
From some of the most arid deserts in the world, the habitat of the Iranian cheetah, to the greenest forests, pastures, and valleys, North Khorasan has it all. Here at the Baba Aman Forest Park, the combination of rivers, waterfalls, and the umbrella of sycamore trees have all created one of the most popular summer hideouts for the people in the region.
There are a number of forest parks in North Khorasan, and Baba Aman is one of the popular ones. In spring and summer, Baba Aman hosts the largest number of visitors. At first sight, the place resembles an oasis. What greets you here upon your arrival is the cool, gentle breeze that touches your face. The symphony of a flowing river and the terraced ponds in the middle of the park complete this good feeling. But our trip to North Khorasan is not all about nature. In this amazing region of Iran, there is a little town which could be considered unique, at least in Iran and its surrounding countries. The exceptional feature of this place unveils itself after a short drive in the town's only boulevard.
We have come to a little town in northeast Iran, a town with only 12,000 inhabitants. What is interesting about it is that it has more than 170 shops that only sell dried nuts and dried snacks, such as kashk. It's a combination of dried curd and herbs and spices. Wow, it's kind of hard, but it's so tasty. Let's get inside and have a look.
Welcome to Faruj, the region's trade hub for dried nuts, trail mixes, and you name it.
One of the things that makes North Khorasan exceptionally beautiful is its untouched natural environment. Many believe that this region could be one of the main destinations for ecotourists in the near future. A few kilometers from the city of Shirvan, a village known as Gelian testifies to this fact.
We head towards a hidden paradise in Iran's northeast. Gelian, also known as Golian, is one of the 365 outstanding tourist villages of Iran. With a population of no more than 700, the inhabitants of this picturesque mountainous area are mainly engaged in farming and animal husbandry. Gelian is situated in a valley. The terraced structure of the village and its adobe buildings, along with very tall trees, are only some of the interesting features of this place. Some people believe that if you're born in Iran and spend an entire lifetime traveling across this country, you still wouldn't be able to see all the beauties of this ancient land. This may be true, but seeing at least a part of beautiful Iran would still be worth it. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
Allah's love has no limits. Allah's love has no boundaries. For every raindrop that falls, for every ray of sunshine, for everything is under His control. You cannot see Allah, you cannot touch Allah, but you can feel Allah. He is there in every tear that falls, in every smile that shows. Allah is all around us. I am whatever I may be, but Allah has already planned my destiny. I am whatever I will be.
WIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Hussein and Sister Zainab are over here in today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and assalamu alaikum to your dear listeners.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother, and to all the listeners.
So, here and there in the news networks and the social media, we hear about the coming attacks of United States of America to Venezuela, which is not taking place yet, okay? It's only a threat. The U.S., fighters are over there, okay? Trump is every day threatening and does not answer, okay, whether to attack Venezuela or not. Now, the major question is that why Venezuela must be considered as a threat for U.S.? This is Zainab, let's start with you.
Okay, so where do I start? So obviously Venezuela itself is one of these, obviously for the U.S., especially for Trump, very threatening and must be so irritating and annoying to Trump, okay. A character such as Trump, because Venezuela, and I'm going to compare Venezuela to Iran and to China and to Russia.
Uh-huh.
So these are countries that do not bow to the U.S. Hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, these countries will be have already signaled in the what we call the multipolar world. And what is it about these sorts of countries? So these are countries that obviously will do their own thing.
Uh-huh.
And especially so Venezuela stands against this of U.S. hegemony is pro-Palestine. We know that under Maduro anyway.
Yes, Maduro.
And as is Iran. But the other thing is obviously these are hugely powerful countries. So Venezuela is very powerful. It has the world's largest oil reserves.
Okay.
It has the eighth largest natural gas reserves.
Wow.
And we've got this whole thing, the typical sort of U.S. meddling, threatening, sanctions, this sort of whole game playing out, which is almost, it's so predictable, it's almost boring. So what do? They sort of choose some sort of random and unimportant opposition leader.
Okay.
And what's the plan of this? Her name is Maria Corina Machado. Her plan is, and you can see videos of her talking about just selling off Venezuela's resources, like $1.7 trillion of it.
Isn't it she lady that won the Nobel Prize, this peace Nobel?
That too.
Wow, okay.
And that also gives us
okay, hand in hand, yeah. Okay, that's
we
right.
know what's coming.
And we know that Trump was supposed to won the Nobel Prize, okay?
Yeah.
One of the candidates was him, okay?
He's very upset, actually.
Okay, he's very upset at why, okay. That's it. Go on.
Yeah, so, and then we've got this going on. So we know that Venezuela is very powerful, stands against the U.S. And the other thing with these countries, so when we look at Venezuela, obviously the U.S. Takes issue with Venezuela anyway.
Okay.
Because it is powerful and because it stands against it and because it's so rich in resources and everything.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, we know the Western hegemony wants to plunder.
Okay.
This is the old colonial mentality. It has not stopped. This is ongoing.
Right.
But the other thing is they and obviously they'll be thinking, now if they hit Venezuela, if they can somehow harm Venezuela, cause it to just turn into a basket case like Syria, basically.
Mm.
They're also hitting one of their other sort of enemies because
mm-hmm.
China is at the moment Venezuela's largest creditor one of its major destinations for oil. So obviously if they can interfere with hit Venezuela, that will also have impact on China.
Okay.
So these are all sort of linked together in a sense.
Okay.
Which
That's
is
it.
Trying to destroy the big players in the multipolar world.
So it's not easy attacking Venezuela right now. So geographically speaking, it's close to the United States of America, okay? But ideologically, it's very much close to China and Russia and Islamic Republic of Iran. So why Islamic Republic of Iran? I mean, this is a major question, okay? Nobody during the history of the world, when you go out and check out the references, will find ties between Venezuela or, for example, Cuba and Islamic Republic of Iran. Why is it so?
That's a good question, actually, but it hasn't been like that always.
All right.
In one sense, Venezuela is like Iran. What sense? In the sense that during Cold War, Venezuela was almost the only country in the Latin America that was anti-communist, mm-hmm. and it was the biggest American player in that region.
Okay.
Like Iran, mm-hmm. which before the revolution used to be American milking cow in the region. And when every Arab country sanctioned Israel for oil, this Mohammad Reza Pahlavi mm-hmm. gave oil to Israel. You see how much of an ally Iran was to America in during the Cold War. And Venezuela was used to be like that, like Iran. But then there was a shift in the history. In Iran, it was through the revolution. In Venezuela, it was through the election of Chavez.
Okay.
So, and there's a reason for that. And the reason is that U.S. does not accept allies, dignified allies. U.S. Uh-huh. accept milking cows, mm-hmm. submissive servants.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
And people start hating themselves. Like nations start feeling that they have been disrespected. When you call a nation milking cow,
all right.
when you treat a nation like they realize generation after generation, these people are just plundering our resources and they are not contributing to the real development of this country. The thing that happened in Iran.
Yes.
So if U.S. would engage. There's something.
That's why Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in the final year of his king.
Yes, he got mad as well.
Yeah. Okay, that okay. We are giving service to you, and now you are not doing anything. To
yes,
us, okay.
He has started admitting it.
Yes,
that after being a buddy for U.S., we don't have, we don't see any concrete or tangible results.
Yes,
it's still the same. Dynamic is going on that they take our resources and they sell us their secondhand
okay.
products. Anyways,
okay.
So for the Venezuelan, it's so I want to say that the reason that Venezuela shifted from being a U.S. proxy in Latin America,
yes,
in the Cold War, in the time of difficulty, the reason that they shifted to an anti-American nation mm-hmm. was U.S. treatment
yes.
of these nations.
Okay.
That they downgrade these nations, they act in a, there's something called in international relations, it's called the engagement policy.
Uh-huh.
They don't apply engagement policy
okay.
to treat them fairly, to give them real development.
Okay.
They create a facade of like the market for our goods and products like they do with the milking cows in,
all right.
in our region. So they sell them, flood the country with American products,
okay.
but they do not give them sustainable development. They
mm-hmm.
do not give them factories. They do not give them industries.
And they are South America.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
have you ever watched the cartoon animation Up?
Yeah.
There are two kids, you know, showing the world map to each other. He said, this is America, but this is South America. I mean, okay, such an ideology in terms of we are North America,
yes,
so we
yes.
are superior to South America.
You have always
okay.
having the Latinos and
Latino.
The whites, so Latinos,
that's right.
obviously.
Okay.
So after all these years of having a sense of shame and embarrassment, Venezuelan
uh-huh.
nation said, okay, let's have some agency and do something, and they brought Chavez into power,
mm-hmm.
and that started the U.S. hatred.
Oh.
Again, like a child that gets angry with someone.
Okay.
And instead of rethinking, what have I done with this ally
mm-hmm.
that they shifted against me, instead of, after the Islamic Revolution, people in the U.S. would say, what did we do wrong with these people that they have shifted against us?
Okay.
The coup against Mossadegh and all the things
yes,
that we did.
Yes.
Let's change course. Let's do some cooperation in the creation of human civilization. Instead of that, they say, okay, now they have turned into our enemies. Let's
mm-hmm.
crush them.
Okay.
And this pushed Venezuela to create alliance with Russia, China, and Iran.
Yes.
Back to your question, why Venezuela is friends with Iran?
Yes.
Because we have shared experience
uh-huh.
of being a U.S. ally,
mm-hmm.
but he treated us in a miserable way, and we decided to have our own agency.
The revolution that took place in Iran 1979, how much do you think was rooted in the ideology of Latin American countries like Cuba, like Venezuela or something like that?
The revolution of Iran, because it happened before the fall of Soviet Union,
uh-huh.
so people were still living in the bipolar world.
Bipolar
world,
that's
okay.
right.
After fall of the Soviet Union, U.S. got prominent position,
uh-huh.
like it was, and it has never been in human history an empire this powerful.
Okay.
So people were still waiting to see what happens to Iran.
Uh-huh.
So it did not have immediate effect because there have been other revolutions that the U.S. had sabotaged and had changed.
All right. Okay?
And that's why Imam Khomeini called the seize of the American embassy the second revolution.
Uh-huh.
Because the U.S. wanted to redirect Iranian revolution.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So because this is a pattern that they do. They do not take involvement immediately. They mm-hmm. just wait for the sentiment to be discharged. And then when the right time comes, they install somebody who is westernized, who is in line with their interest, and then they redirect the whole thing.
That's right.
That's why they have two options. They have regime change,
okay.
and they have behavior change.
All
so
right.
they tried regime change Iran, they failed. They tried behavior change of Iran, they failed. And after that, these nations, independent nations, they realized, okay, it is possible.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
Again, the same scenario as they called, I could remember George Bush called, for example, Iran and this and that, the axis of devil or something?
Evil, yeah.
Evil, that's right. So here they call, for example, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela as the axis of, we can say, that's right, authoritarianism.
You always have a sprinkle of democracy exporting,
yes,
and
okay.
we care about the dictatorship in this country,
okay.
as if their own allies are not dictatorship
okay.
in our region. So it's not about democracy, but you always have this in the pretext that the Americans put forth
mm-hmm.
for their intervention.
Okay.
Democracy is...
And the U.S. is really threatened that the message of revolution of Iran reaches South America, but North Americans want not. I mean, this is really, really strikingly shocking that, for example, how geographically speaking, for example, the message of your own people from the same continent will not reach you, but the messages from the other continent will reach you so far.
Yeah, well, obviously the propaganda started regarding Venezuela. It's been ongoing
okay.
for a while. And then so there's really crazy comments, absolutely, just incredible. So they took the typical things. Obviously, they're saying that there's Russian agents, Iranian agents in Venezuela, and that even Hamas and Hezbollah are
okay.
operating in Venezuela.
What's the problem with that? I mean, being, for example, Iran's or Hamas agents being in Venezuela. What's the problem?
Well, for them, because they started the revolution or whatever
okay.
the shift that they started, because they wanted to say that we have national agency,
uh-huh.
they labeling them in such
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, with foreign meddling.
So
okay.
To make them another problem.
Okay, Sister Zainab, go on, sorry.
Yeah, obviously, they've got, this is the one thing they want to take away from the fact that this is Venezuela's own, well, at the moment, there's a response to the threats by Trump, obviously. There's huge rallies in the country
uh-huh.
ongoing, even though the sort of, this sort of opposition leader, this not very important
okay.
person, because
yes.
a Nobel Peace Prize means nothing these
yes.
days anyway.
All right.
But the interesting thing is, I was reading a comment by a sort of non-Venezuelan person who said that you had visited
mm-hmm.
Venezuela maybe a couple of decades back, and was saying how, although, you know, and he obviously was not dealing with the normal people,
mm-hmm.
like the huge middle class, or also the poorer class.
Yes.
He was obviously talking with the wealthy, the upper class, upper middle class, who seemed to be having a really good lifestyle. And he was sort of thinking, well, you know, and obviously we know that this is the other thing. If the U.S. or the West wants to intervene in any way, do this, sort of whatever is a soft war, or just somehow have a regime change from within a country, try and do this, they will target also the ones who are sort of maybe a bit more pro-West. And typically, these are the ones who really just want to enjoy, let's say, more stuff.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
they'll be quite happy to have their mark, as you say, flooded with sort of U.S. things and just increase their luxurious lifestyle, because obviously the tendency is that they maybe don't care
mm-hmm.
for what's happening to the rest of the population. That
okay.
goes for any country.
Yes.
We have a bit of this sort of total indifference. But, you know, the... Maduro has huge popular support.
Yes.
And these the smart, the elite, the wealthy elite, well, I won't call them
okay.
elite,
yes.
just the wealthy class, Yeah, they're the same everywhere.
Upper middle class.
That's
this
right.
is, again, in U.S. international relations, they invest a lot on upper middle class or higher than that in order to take their agenda aligned the way. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
That's it. Sometimes I think to myself that, historically speaking, South America is taking a revenge, a historical revenge from the white supremacy of the North America.
There is
the Native Americans, we can't say the land which belonged to them once, okay, is now being occupied by white supremacy. And now, during the presidency of Trump, you know, this is becoming aggravated because he is, we can't say, how can I say, the model for white supremacy. Yeah, an icon of white supremacy.
Yes, it is. It somehow is true. The historical background is there, okay?
Okay.
The divide is there already.
Mm-hmm.
But again, some people would bring this up in order to say that these people are some fanatic. They are, because of some historical revenge, they're destroying themselves. More than that, I believe this is something that people like, and that is that they want independence. They
mm-hmm.
want resources to be for themselves. And when it comes to the current president of the United States, he has such an impulsive personality.
Yeah.
He has said it time and again that peace through a strength. Have you heard this? He says that he wants, and he has this thing, to make a reckless, impulsive move,
okay,
and then see the results. So
mm-hmm.
if you ask about the future of what's going to happen in Venezuela-American relationship,
yes,
I don't see it very remote that Americans make a reckless move. Like, for example, especially learning from Zionists,
uh-huh,
if they want to apply one surgical operation, like surgical assassination, they may attempt to kill Maduro or whatever, things
yes.
like that,
okay,
in order to make the move, and then they see the result. If they don't see any pushback,
mm-hmm.
they go forward.
They go forward.
This is the personality of Trump.
Yes.
And he said it in several times, like there's this very good book, War,
mm-hmm.
that is about the personality of this guy. And he says that he believes in throwing a punch and then seeing what happens. And by that assessment, he comes forward.
Okay.
If you don't take the right measure against the first punch, then you're gonna receive more punches along the way.
All right, that's it. As Ayatollah Khamenei in his visit to Maduro has said that to assume U.S. invincible is a major oversight, you know,
mm.
okay? So, and yeah, this has always been, even Fidel Castro had a visit to Ayatollah Khamenei on that time, and they admired him and Ayatollah Khamenei as a role model for being anti-hegemonic, and we can say anti-Western hegemony in the West. And this is really, this must be outstanding for the people of the Muslim lands, that how non-Muslims rely on a Muslim figure over here to be the role model for them for anti-hegemony, okay?
Also, you see the pictures of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Venezuela.
Yes.
They see these people, Sardar Soleimani, General Soleimani, they see these people.
Nelson Mandela had a visit also to Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yes.
He said, so my leader, okay?
My leader. Yeah.
In a video, Nelson Mandela calls Ayatollah Khamenei my leader, and this is really outstanding, okay?
So because to keep a revolution on its track
mm-hmm.
for 40 years
uh-huh.
in a world dominated by U.S. is very difficult.
Okay.
I mean, it has been proven to be impossible because U.S., what it does, it has redirect revolutions very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Egypt. They said, okay, we want to have our country back. They
right.
toppled this person. The other person came. It's even worse than the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is because of the leadership and the steering of this thing throughout all the ups and downs of
right.
the international relations. That's why they see people who are leaders
right.
themselves, they realize the strategic significance
okay.
of this.
Ayatollah Khamenei, in part of his speech, you know, in the visit to Maduro, says that in the past, when some Islamic countries decided to confront the Zionist regime by refusing to sell their oil, Westerners created uproar with the excuse that Islamic countries are making political use of the oil. However, today, in complete harmony with American policies, the same countries are using oil as a weapon in cooperation with some members of the OPEC and some countries in our region, which are harmed by these policies themselves.
Yeah, no surprise.
Mastery over the history of the world. May Allah safeguard our leader, all the freedom seekers all across the world, you know, and those justice seekers all across the world, whether Muslims or non-Muslims. Sheikh Hussein and Sister Zainab, thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding what's happening in Venezuela. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much for being with us with the program Viewpoints. If you have any question, if you want to visit more about our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Do not forget us in your supplications and du'as. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know that one day suddenly this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting topic, and that topic is about what are the etiquettes of a judge. Of course, here by judge, we mean a judge, the judge who sits in the court and passes judgment over cases, legal cases. In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from some of the hadiths which have been passed down to us from the infallibles, alayhim as-salam, regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith, Imam Ali, alayhi as-salam, he said this to a person named Shurey, who he had appointed as a judge. Do not whisper to anyone in your court. And if you get angry, leave, and do not judge while you are angry. So one of the etiquettes of the judge is that he should not pass judgment whilst he is angry, at the time he is angry. In the book Da'im al-Islam, famous book, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam forbade a judge to pass judgment whilst being angry, hungry, or tired. So one of the etiquettes of the judge is that he should not pass judgment while he is overcome by sleep or he is excessively tired. Also, in another interesting hadith, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, the judge should not pass judgment between two people unless he is satiated with food and water. So a condition for the judge is that he should not pass judgment while he is hungry or thirsty excessively, such that it could, you know, affect his judgment. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam narrated, a person was a guest of the commander of the faithful and stayed with him for some days. He then presented him with a prior dispute that he had not mentioned to the commander of the faithful. The Imam alayhi salam said the following to him, are you making a formal complaint? He said, yes. The Imam said, transfer from us, meaning leave our house. For the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam forbade the hosting of a plaintiff for one for whom one is judge, unless the rival plaintiff is also with him. So one of the etiquettes of a judge is that he should not host any of the plaintiffs as a guest. In the book Mustadrak al-Wasail, it's been narrated that the Prophet forbade the judge to favor one of the plaintiffs over the other by looking at him too much or paying more attention to him, and he also forbade suborning witnesses. So this is another one of those etiquettes of the judge. The judge should not suborn the witness, and he should not favor one witness over the other by excessively looking at him or paying too much attention to him to the detriment of the other. In one hadith, it's been narrated that the Prophet said this to Imam Ali: when two people bring a case against each other before you to be judged, do not judge the first before you hear out the second. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of judges in the light of the hadith of the infallibles, alayhim assalam. Until next time, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program, The Key, on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
from beautiful Tehran, a heartfelt salam to each of you. You're tuned in Iran Radio, and I'm your host here to guide you through an enriching day of discovery and insight. Please settle in. What you'll hear today just might make your day brighter. We begin this hour with further radio productions. Then join us for Bridge, a brief commentary on profound supplications, hosted by Sheikh Mehdi Dardashtian. Bridge offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the noble book of Sahifa Sajjadiyah by Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him. Next, we open the door to Dialogue, hosted by Sayyid Shahriyar Naqvi. Dialogue is a look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams with their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics and doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Following this, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Stay tuned. The next is another segment of our radio productions.
Welcome back to The Voice of War. My guest today is Professor Ilan Papet, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. You, as well as other prominent thinkers like Professor Mearsheimer, have drawn very strong links between AIPAC, the Zionist lobby, writ large, Israeli politicians, along with US neocons, to push the agenda of initially, obviously, the Iraq war, but then subsequent wars as well. And many big thinkers actually attribute most of the wars in the Middle East over the past 25 or so years to this kind of same tension or the same push from the blending of the neocons with the Zionists. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I take a bit somewhat different view on this in a way, and I think there's a difference between American imperialist impulses that the lobby is not responsible. I mean, that's the American, certain American way of thinking of what should be America's role in the world, and I don't think you can pin it on the lobby. This is, with this I agree with Noam Chomsky, who says that this is the main push for American. After all, the Israeli lobby is not responsible for what the Americans did in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia, in Central America, South America. I mean, there is an American imperialist impulse, very yeah. strong one, but it has nothing to do with the lobby. However, when it comes to Israel itself and the area around Israel, that's when the lobby is effective in convincing the American imperialists that American imperialist interests are best served through Israel. The Israelis are really panicking for what they saw yesterday on the White House. When President Trump says Saudi Arabia is as important to us as Israel, which is exactly what he said they're as important as Israel. Israel is not more important than Saudi Arabia. This is a moment, you never know with Trump. I mean, you don't know if there's any substance behind his statement. But let's say it is a substantial statement. Let's say it's not even a whimsical kind of utterance, that it's part of a possible strategic idea of how America's world would look like, America's involvement in the Middle East will look like in the next decade or two. That means that the imperialist impulse is not based necessarily on a strong alliance with Israel. It's maybe based on a strong alliance with Arab states that are pro-American. It creates much less problem if you think about it. The Saudis, of course, nobody cares about civil rights and human rights records, but it's easier to overlook the violation of human rights, civil rights in Saudi Arabia. It's not easy to overlook the violation of the Palestinian rights by Israel. And that could be
well. It's one journalist.
Challenge.
One journalist that's really. Sorry to interrupt. There was one journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, that really draws some heat.
Yeah.
You know, between MBS and Trump in the recent press.
Absolutely. And America always say dictators are fine as long as they are our dictators. The point is that the lobby. If the lobby would face an America that says, yes, we still want to be a dominant power in the world and in your neighborhood in the Middle East, but you know what? We don't need you. Then the lobby would find it very difficult to be effective, I think.
Mm.
So it's a cynical way of looking at the future by which you understand, and I always say it in the book, my last book, as an historian, the ability to relieve people from oppression and occupation is not always achieved by a pure, just moral struggle. Sometimes it is being achieved by more cynical development, for which you have very little, on which you have very little influence, but have an impact on your life, whether you are enthusiastic about these changes or not, it doesn't matter. In the end of the day, it can create a different reality. Similar to the impact of the end of the Cold War on the chances of toppling the apartheid regime in South Africa. It was a very important development without which the apartheid would have lingered on for a while if the Cold War would have not ended and the Soviet Union would have not collapsed.
So how do you see then the current situation in the U.S.? I mean, obviously, with Trump, we don't really know what's going to happen next. But it's without a shadow of a doubt, I think the civil society, in fact, his base, is hugely split. And the single issue that's splitting his base is Israel. You know, not least because of Gaza, but also the amount of money that U.S. sends to Israel. You know, many openly say that the U.S. is run by Israel because of these kind of blind loyalty to Netanyahu and his government, but also things like the assassination of Charlie Kirk. There's competing narratives, all of which somehow center around U.S. support for Israel or Mossad's influence in the U.S. And of course, probably the biggest one is Epstein, which of course there are issues and questions of who is guilty on both sides of the aisle in the U.S., but there's an overarching narrative there, especially now that we're hearing, as of today, that most likely we won't see the files released despite it passing House and Senate, and Trump will most likely sign it, because of national security implications. And many are drawing, some better than others, conclusions that the national security risk really is the expose of a foreign intelligence service, i.e. Mossad, having played a key part in the propping up of Epstein. How do you view that from your perspective?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the source of power for AIPAC is the Capitol Hill, not the White House. There were presidents that AIPAC didn't like. Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, George Bush Sr., to mention the three most courageous presidents, at least facing some of AIPAC's pressure. Even Reagan had a clash with AIPAC. So the source of power is not the White House. The source of power is Capitol Hill. Until we don't hear different voices from there, presidents come and go. The lobby in the Capitol Hill stays. You have to pay attention to Capitol Hill. That's where the source of power for AIPAC and the other sections of the lobby exist. So all these developments that you rightly describe, we need to see if they are reflected in the change of attitude in Capitol Hill, not in the White House. Now, I do believe that you're right, that a younger generation of Republicans would be much more isolationist in terms in the context of Israel would be a limit to how much money they think the United States should invest in sustaining Israeli policies and adventures. I think we should pay attention to the younger democratic generation. They already have shown in the municipal elections last week their ability to even win in places which traditionally were kind of blue-collar people, blue-collar workers were voting even for Trump. So I think, yes, that there is a trend in the society that would distances the United States from Israel. But I haven't seen yet its impact on Capitol Hill, you know, on the decision taken by either the House of Representatives or the Senate. But I do believe it will happen. I do believe that these are very slow processes. We have to remember that the lobby is still connected to the arms lobby, to the multinational corporation that still see Israel as a good investment for high-tech, pharmaceutical technologies, and of course security and military industries. We should not underestimate the importance of these powerful lobbies to join forces with the lobby of Israel. But again, the question is, do these lobbies need Israel if indeed the Arab world is going to provide a much better and easier market or collaboration, you know? I think the bottom line of what we are talking about is A, not to take a determinist view on American policy. Also, historically, I can show that it was not always, as people think, totally anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. So let's not take a determinist view on it. Secondly, there are all kinds of possible scenarios, one through a more progressive democratic success, one through maybe less attractive to me, but a more isolationist Republican success. Either way, it's part of the same, you know, matrix of processes that lead us to think that the position of Israel becomes much more vulnerable and precarious as we look into a more distant future.
So do you place the recent purchase of things like TikTok and the, you know, installation of prominent Zionists in, you know, CBS News, yes,
CBS, yes.
Whatever the, yeah. That's right. In the U.S., do you see that as part of that tactic to try and reassert itself amongst the younger audiences? Because I think that's where they've really lost the support.
Yeah, and it won't work. They will fail because TikTok, in the end of the day, is a means to a goal. It's not the goal itself. It's just a vehicle. The passengers determine the direction of the trip, not the manufacturer of the car, so to speak. So I don't think it will work. I think this is like the tough legislation against BDS. All that is a fight back. Of course, they're fighting back for their power. I don't think they even fight back anymore for Israel. I think that's what I write in the book. I said that the lobby became a powerful organization that seeks power for the sake of power. I don't think they're even working for Israel anymore.